Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's August the 19th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune. And hurrah, my voice for freedom, is the rising.
I'd like to begin today with an apology. For the past 4 or 5 days, I've had a bit of a respiratory condition here, and I'm still feeling a little ill, so during this broadcast, my voice will probably sound even more gravelly than usual. Next, I'd like to slip in a word to the wise. I assume that most of you are familiar with what happened to our erstwhile comrade, Hal Turner, last Friday. Now, we have a teachable moment here, people. If ever you're tempted or pressured to become an informant for our friends in the silk suits, don't believe a damned word they say when they promise to protect you. As soon as you become an embarrassment, the Bureau will wash their hands of you and throw you under the bus in a heartbeat. I ask Hal Turner. Friday the 13th was indeed unlucky for Hal. On August the 13th, 2010, after just 2 hours of deliberations, a federal jury of 4 men and 8 women ended a 4-day trial by convicting Turner on a single count of threatening to assault or murder judges on his blog. The judge in the case ordered Turner held without bail as a danger to the community. I guess His Honor thought Turner might somehow get to a microphone. A sentencing date has not been set, but he's looking at 10 years for doing what his FBI handlers told him to do and paid him to do. It's worth noting that 2 previous trials, on December the 7th, 2009, and on March the 10th, 2010, both ended in mistrials. Now, the case against Turner must have been really weak, but Turner's former employers went after him 3 times. Now, that's what I call termination with extreme prejudice. Now, this does not bode well for poor Edgar Steele. The beast does not like being deprived of its little morsels of human flesh. The prosecution called both Turner's handlers, Sergeant Leonard Nurbetsky of the New Jersey State Police and FBI Special Agent Stephen Haug, and both calmly sat there on the witness stand and swore away the life of the man they had once pretended friendship with and promised to protect from any legal repercussions for the weird internet behavior that he was engaging in, I repeat, at the behest of the FBI. Why on God's green earth would anyone with 2 brain cells to rub together ever believe a single word that a federal law enforcement agent says? Police in general, and federal law enforcement agents in particular, are almost by definition sociopaths and pathological liars. They wouldn't be attracted to that kind of career if something wasn't wrong in their minds to begin with. They're incapable by their very nature of playing straight with anyone. Never, ever trust these people. They have no sense of honor, no sense of decency, sincere fair play, and no compunction about using other human beings and then throwing them away when their usefulness ends. They will pretend to be your bestest buddy on earth and be so concerned about your welfare and the welfare of your family until they've gotten what they want out of you, and then as far as they're concerned, you're about as disposable as toilet paper. To a federal agent, it's all about him or her getting the big bust, getting the commendations in their personnel file, their career, their self-aggrandizement. You're nothing but a stepping stone to his or her objective, and when they are through with you, they'll toss you aside like an empty beer can. Looks like our old buddy Hal is going to have 10 long years to regret the day he ever trusted an FBI agent. Next, a brief Edgar Steele update. Looks like, at the last minute, the trial's now been postponed to November the 1st. It was supposed to have started on Monday, August the 16th. Let's hope that Steele's court-appointed defense counsel, who still apparently doesn't have a name, uses that time to look into all the aspects and possibilities of government fabrication of audio files. Just on general principles, I'd love to see somebody successfully challenge government wiretaps and other covert recordings, because I know there's been a lot of suspicion in the past that these audios have been tampered with in other cases, organized crime, surveillance tapes, and whatnot. And most juries are so dumb that they assume the accused person is bound to be guilty or it wouldn't be there. Now, there is another development in the Steele case which I find very significant, if it's true. But unfortunately, the only source for this information we have so far is a rather dubious one, and for that reason, I won't mention anything about this until I can get it confirmed or denied one way or the other. Right, first email from Brian in Arkansas. Hello, HAC. I have a question for a possible discussion on your podcasts, which, by the way, I enjoy. I'm in the camp that would like to hear more shows per week. I also enjoy your music selections immensely. Continue what you're doing. Don't be persuaded by the naysayers on changing your style. Back to the question or questions. It seems that the Northwest Front's real chance of succeeding is all predicated on the current system collapsing socially or financially. Basically, major upheaval will have to occur to seriously get people to respond the way we want. Now, what if the system is able to stabilize the economy and put in enough patches to keep things running moderately smoother, or at least on a much slower decline, where the white people's comfort level is basically being met, or somewhat met, and where they once again become pacified zombies and do nothing for the next few years? I fear that since the white race is on a demographic clock to extinction and will more likely pass the point of no return within a decade or two, the system can basically play for time. That is, just give the whites enough of a bone to think things are about to turn around. Of course, it's all lies and trickery, and all of the promises and hope will be pulled away and fade into oblivion when there's no chance of white recovery, mobilization, or resistance. Is it possible to recruit individuals to our movement in an environment that the majority of the people think is good for them? We don't have the time to squander. Would like to hear your thoughts and comments on this. Brian, in a way, I almost hope that does happen, to give us a little more time, because I'm going to be honest with you. I'm becoming very worried that the window of opportunity is going to appear and then pass us by, and we're still going to be dicking around. Now, to be sure, some progress is being made. Now, for the first time in a long time, in this coming month of September, I've got something like a full schedule of meet and greets for people who are actually coming in from outside the home land doing scouting trips. The number of weekly hits on the northwestfront.org website is slowly inching upward. Like I said, some progress is being made, but it is so glacially slow. And who knows how many of these people who are now at least bestirring themselves to make scouting trips will actually end up coming home for good. And of those, how many will become activists with the party and not just find a hole to hide from Obama in and pull it in after him? People we really, really need for our websites and our YouTubes and for Radio Free Northwest to start going viral and picking up boku viewers and listeners, and this needs to happen really quickly. As to whether or not the system will be able to stabilize, now that's possible, yes, if they can somehow stop the foreclosures and prevent too many more job losses, and above all, find some way to keep things going without the Federal Reserve printing up trillions and zillions more money and thus causing hyperinflation. Hyperinflation would probably finish the country off right now, given the weakened condition it's already in from the past 30 years of madness. But if it does stabilize, a tremendous amount of damage will already have been done, and white people will have lost an immense amount of their personal wealth and hence a lot of their motivation to remain loyal. Their faith in the system is already permanently shaken no matter what happens. Things will stabilize, if they do, at a much lower level, kind of like the Titanic stopping and floating a bit 1,000 fathoms down while the last air bubbles are squeezed out of it before it continues sinking on down to the bottom 3 miles below. Millions of white families will have lost their homes through foreclosure, and tightened up lending rules will make sure that most of them never again achieve home ownership, and they spend the rest of their lives in rented and manufactured housing, i.e. trailers. A whole generation of white middle-class Brady Bunch wannabes are going to end up living in trailer parks. Already, the establishment media are beginning to refer to 10% official unemployment as the new normal. Now, that 10% unemployed translates into 20% out here in the real world. And a lot of those unemployed and those systems analysts and executives who have been forced to push brooms and flip burgers will be white men who are itching for some revenge on the government and the country that used them and betrayed them. True, there are still a few tricks that the system can come up with to pull a rabbit out of Obama's ears. I, for one, wouldn't be too surprised to see them fall back on the old reliable formula of war. After all, it was World War II that pulled America out of the First Depression, not the New Deal. I imagine a war with Iran would fill the bill quite nicely, because on top of the two brushfire wars that the Americans are already running right now in Iraq and Afghanistan, a proper full-blown war, as one with a country the size and population of Iran probably would be, would start up all kinds of defense-related factories and industries and force them to start hiring. A major war would get a lot of the bad economic news off the front page. Or, since newspapers are almost extinct these days, I suppose I should say it'll get a lot of the bad economic news off CNN and Fox and Matt Drudge. Above all, if the regime can ever screw its courage to the sticking point and reinstitute the draft, war can provide a real handy-dandy solution to the problem of youth unemployment. They pretty much have to institute the draft, I think. Even as bad as the economy is, I think volunteerism has pretty much run its course, because the percentage of young people of all races who are willing to go and get blown to pieces in Baghdad or Kabul merely for a monthly paycheck and a chance at a roach-infested VA hospital is limited, and already they're getting used up in Iraq and Afghanistan. But war will also create a phenomenon of tens of thousands of young and disillusioned veterans being released onto America's streets with nowhere to go. Guys who have been trained to fight and then kicked loose once the system no longer has any use for them. Kedai's Lockhart types. History teaches that's a dangerous situation, and even if it does stabilize without war, Brian, like I said earlier, white people's trust in the system has already been very badly eroded and shattered. As I keep saying, guys, it's not like we're trying to convert 50 million people to our way of thinking in one fell swoop. I only need 1,000 or so Class A's here in the Northwest. Intelligent, brave, and dedicated men and women who are free of encumbrances and who are therefore able to devote their lives solely to this cause. Now give me those first 1,000, Brian, under any circumstances, and I will give you a Northwest Republic. This is maybe wandering a wee bit off topic, but I think that a lot of Americans have a secret desire for the system not to stabilize. I think a lot of very ordinary white people secretly long to have some kind of deus ex machina crisis or natural disaster kick over the whole apple cart. Let me ask you something. Have you guys noticed an increase over the past 10 years or so in all these apocalyptic movies, disaster flicks, wherein the whole ball of wax is about to come apart? Okay, this is an old cinematic theme, goes all the way back to Mad Max and before, but I get a genuine, almost wistful sense of longing of some of these recent films, a longing for true change, even if it's for the bad, and there sure are a lot of them of late. The plots vary. Sometimes it's a comet or an asteroid crashing into the Earth. Sometimes it's a global warming-related flood. Sometimes it's a big earthquake. But always it has the effect of destroying the existing society and getting the monkey of the law and the government off white people's backs. Now, the latest two of these flicks, pretty big budget ones, are The Book of Eli, which I have no intention of seeing because it's got a stupid nigger in the lead, and The Road, which stars Viggo Mortensen, and which I probably will see. I did watch one of these apocalypse flicks a while back, a movie called 2012, and while it's a pretty stupid flick, all told, it's worth sitting through just to watch the city of Los Angeles collapse and fall into the sea. The thing about these movies is that whatever the disaster is, it always reduces the world to an allegedly uncivilized state, but also a free state, with the federal monkey off Americans' backs. No police, no FBI agents cruising in their black cars and shades and silk suits, no judges in black robes to punish white people anymore for taking what the rich Jews and businessmen don't want them to have, no media to target and victimize white people who speak up, no one to fire you from your job if you say nigger or faggot out loud, none of the 10,001 petty little rules and regulations we have to live by and which make any kind of real life and happiness impossible in America. In these apocalypse flicks, a fantasy situation arises where the hero can actually shoot the zombies or the mutants or the aliens or the outlaws or whoever's trying to mess with him and his family. And I think that's the main attraction of these movies. White men long for just that situation. The ability, finally, to kill their enemies. Right now, all white men are allowed to do when they are wronged and robbed and insulted is to call Rush Limbaugh on the phone and whine. And I think deep down it fills them with rage and frustration that there never seems to be any real justice or any real change. A white man secretly long for the ability to blow some nigger's brains all over the sidewalk and shoot some liberal asshole in the belly and watch him roll around screaming, or stick the barrel of a pistol up a faggot's ass and give him a .44 caliber enema. Okay, that may sound a little bit rough, but why do you think that certain movie scenes just seem to resonate down through the years, like Clint Eastwood saying, "Make my day," or Robert De Niro saying, "You talking to me?" or Arnold Schwarzenegger saying, "I'll be back." what follows those scenes in the movies? White men shooting their enemies. And that is what white men secretly long to do. We don't have enough physical courage yet to actually do it in real life. And in these cinematic fantasies and in the fantasies in our own minds, it requires some act of God or nature to magically lift the iron heel off of our backs before we can indulge our fantasy of killing our enemies. But the fantasy is definitely there in the white man's mind. And the fact is that when something good or bad is in people's minds, it will eventually break free into reality. Now, the police and the FBI are the key, of course. Remove them from the equation and white people will at long last be free to do the necessary. But for some reason, whereas we are theoretically, at least, prepared to go forth and battle the hordes of city niggers and drug addicts or beaners or weirdos and purple mohawks who would be our enemies in some post-apocalyptic world, we won't battle cops or FBI agents in the here and now. We have to have this apocalypse scenario as a kind of permission to be brave. I think most white men are probably still capable of heroic deeds deep down, all right, but we have to have some kind of permission, some sort of official suspension of the rules. As I've said before, white people are now basically a form of domestic animals. We've been domesticated by the Jews, and we can't do anything unless and until Master says it's okay and rewards us with a Scooby snack. Now, what we have to do with our own people psychologically is to get a domesticated dog to return to the wild, to become a wolf again, and all of a sudden turn on his Jewish master and tear the kike's arm off at the shoulder. Okay, this is a group called Changes. I don't know enough about them to know if they're one of ours or not. Anyway, the song's called Waiting for the Fall.
There's talk of revolution, impending civil war. The lines are being drawn, the writing's on the wall. Ancient spirits slumber, the calm before the storm. Fear awakes, it stretches, reaches for his sword. Waiting for the fall, my friend, just waiting for the fall. Waiting for the fall, my friend, I am waiting for the fall. The first shots have been fired, the battle has begun. The blood-red tide is rising, swelling like a flood. An age of soot and ashes, hero takes his stand. Let's have this out with fate, my brothers, liberate our land. Waiting for the fall, my friend, just waiting for the fall. Waiting for the fall, my friend, I am waiting for the fall. Waiting for the fall, my friend, I am waiting for the fall. Waiting for the fall, my friend, I am waiting for the fall.
Okay, guys, now begins the great experiment, and I'll tell you what that is. For those of you who don't know or haven't figured it out, I want to confess something here. Ever since Radio Free Northwest has been on the air, I have been scripting these episodes. What you're actually hearing is, well, a little bit of ad-lib and a little bit of extemporaneous BS from me, but mostly it's a presentation. I'm reading a speech here. Now, this is the impression that I got from most of you. There was what you wanted. However, I'm going to try an experiment here. I'm going to try for the rest of this particular episode of Radio Free Northwest just winging it. I've got a few talking points here, some notes that I'm going to be going over, and I'm going to try just talking to you like we were sitting across from each other at my kitchen table and, you know, having a cup of coffee, something like that. There's a couple of reasons for this. You may remember that a couple of weeks ago, I put out a feeler, said, hey, you guys want more than one Radio Free Northwest per week? And if so, I have a way that maybe I can do it. Now, the way that I was planning on doing those two shows a week was to do what I'm doing now, just simply winging it, ad-libbing it, just sitting down here talking to you in a normal tone of voice and seeing, you know, what crosses my mind and then saying what crosses my mind and seeing how that works out. Now, I have been writing scripts for these programs, like I said, every time now. This is, I believe, the 30th episode. And each of those scripts was in order to give me about an hour in broadcast length, adding, you know, considering the music and so forth. Each of those scripts was roughly 8,000 to 8,500 words. Now, that works out to about 34,000 or so words per month. And that's the equivalent every 3 months of another novel. So in essence, in order to keep up with these scripts for Radio Free Northwest, it's like I'm writing another novel every 3 months. And so that's one reason I'm going to see if I can maybe cut back a little on the time that I spend on these scripts, because frankly, if I'm going to be doing that much writing, you know, it might as well be another novel. So that's one of the reasons I'm going to diddle around here with some ad lib and see if I'm capable of just doing one of these shows off the cuff. Now, I'm a little bit worried about my tendency to go off and ramble like Grandpa Simpson. I really don't want to, you know, do that. I really don't want to, you know, go at, like, I guess like most people, I tend to wander back into the old days and talk about, well, in them days I went over to Shelbyville and I was looking for a turkey, which was known as a walking bird, and I had an onion on my belt, which was the style at the time, and blah, 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 blah. I'm sure you've seen Grandpa Simpson on the show, but I really don't want to come off like that. And I do have a tendency to digress and ramble, and so we'll just have to see how the editing feature on my WavePad soundware or software deals with that. Now, I can't guarantee that this is going to produce anything that's listenable, but I'm going to try. I've got some talking points here. These are actually notes that I made for future shows. I'm just going to go over some of them. We may end up having a Jim Giles moment here. I don't know. And, you know, please don't take that. I mean, I'm not knocking Jim Giles. I mean, I think he's funny as hell. But let's face it, what we're trying to do here isn't really funny. And Jim, like I say, he's just Jim. As I've said before, he's a true Nietzschean man. He has overthrown the tyranny of intellect. So he does his thing the way he does it, but that's not the way I want to do it. I don't really want to just sit here and ramble and babble for once or twice a week. These shows have to accomplish something. And so what I want you to do, I want you to let me know after you listen to this show which you think is better. The first part of the show was scripted in the normal way. And like I say, for the second half, this time I'm just going to try babbling and winging it, and we'll see what comes out. Let me know what kind of impression these two formats or styles give to you, and so I need to figure out how I'm going to proceed here. Now, I've also got a little bit of a problem in that, as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, I've got a bit of a bug at the moment, and right now, to be honest, I'm feeling like 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag, so you need to take that into consideration. This is not only the first time I've tried ad-libbing, but I'm not exactly fully up to snuff here while doing it, so the result might be not quite up to what it might be if I acquired a little practice, and already I'm doing it. I'm rambling. I'm wandering off into a tangent here. Okay, so let's see if I can get back to my talking points. Okay, I'm looking at my notes here, and the first thing I see on here is Northwest weather, and I have no idea on earth where that came from. I do get emails occasionally from people who complain and moan about, oh, Harold, we can't possibly come to the Northwest. It's so cold up there. Yeah. And these complaints generally will come from someplace like Texas or Arizona or Southern California or some other place where these people during the summer spend about 6 months out of the year with their noses stuck in their air conditioners. So let me put it this way. The Northwest climate is approximately the same kind of climate that our ancestors came from. And I believe that at least some part of the white man's problem in the past few centuries has been this tendency to try and inhabit and conquer very hot climates. White people are not meant to exist in hot climates. We need four distinguishable seasons. The winter needs to be very cold. The summer needs to be warm. warm, possibly even a little uncomfortably warm, but not burning oven-like hot, and there need to be very distinct springs and falls in order for our minds and our instincts and our personalities to develop as they should, because this is what we were used to in the lands that we evolved in the lands that we come from. And things like the seasons and so forth have entered into our culture and our heritage in a way that's really kind of hard to shake. It's like, you know, when I was living in the Southern Hemisphere, it was kind of odd in South Africa and Rhodesia to see people celebrating Christmas in the height of summer with all kinds of, you know, snow and mistletoe and Christmas trees and all this Yule logs and all that sort of stuff that comes from a northern winter. But these were customs that had been brought, you know, from the Northern Hemisphere by our people. But we don't just bring customs. We bring, I think, a genetic connection with the weather and climate. One thing I noticed when I went to Europe, my first winter in Ireland was really wretched. I was sick all the time. I had a sore throat. I had bad lungs and all this just congestion, and it was just really wretched. But after that, I didn't have too much trouble, and I think it's because my body was remembering what life and the climate should be like. I mean, maybe that's a little bit off, but that's just an impression I have. Anyway, I think one of the main advantages to Northwest migration for the white man is the fact that it will be returning us to a climate that we are more suited for. I mean, there are people right now in the movement who, and well, among the white community as a whole, who apparently aren't comfortable unless it's warm enough in their bedrooms to grow a potted palm tree. And I honestly don't think that we really belong in places like the Gulf Coast or Texas or California. And yes, I know that's going to be heresy to a lot of people, especially Texans. And yes, I'm aware of the fact that a lot of our history, including a lot of the history of the South, is built in these climates and comes from these climates. So, you know, I'm not saying that we should never have gone there at all, but I don't think it's natural for white people to try and subsist in a culture that is very hot, that has very long and humid jungle-like summers. I think that's one of the reasons also that the races that did evolve in these climates are so more or less lazy, because for 6 months out of the year, it's basically too hot to move. Whereas on the other hand, with our Iceman heritage in the North Country, in the winter, when it gets cold, you damn well better move or you won't survive. And I'm starting to ramble again, but I think you get the idea. Anyway, getting back to the complaints about Northwest weather, the weather here gets a bad rap, I think. Like, for instance, in the Puget Sound area, yeah, there is a fair amount of rain during the winter. But during the summer, no. I think Seattle gets a very bad rap rain-wise. Now, down in Astoria on the coast, yeah, it's pretty wet and pretty cloudy, and we do get a lot more precipitation down there than you do more inland. But here in the Puget Sound area, it's a very, I think, comfortable climate. Some people find the winters a little dreary. I warn newcomers who come here that your first winter here will probably be a little bit rough, because people who come from outside, especially places like California and Texas and Florida, have a tendency to suffer from what they call SAD, seasonally affected disorder. Basically, the long, dreary, dark winter days tend to get to you. And up here, if you're rich, you can buy all these little sort of infrared lamps and everything for your house so that your house sort of impersonates a sunny morning and you don't get, you know, sad, etc., etc. But I found that people adjust to it after, you know, a couple of years. And pretty soon you come to, you know, accept, you know, a long, you know, gray and dark winter as normal. There is one thing I will say about the winters here in the Seattle area, and this is going to sound really ridiculous, but I've never seen nights that are so dark here. Possibly it's because the cloud cover gets way down low. I mean, I'll be out at night in this area, and I'll be standing right under a street light, and there'll be like this little puddle of light, and my body isn't even visible below the waist. It's kind of like it's a positive darkness, and that can get a bit wearing. Like I say, once until you get used to it. But basically, someone once said that every Northwest winter is the same, and yet every Northwest summer is different. And I found that's true, especially here, you know, west of the Cascades. Now, in the inland Northwest, we do have the four-season type climate. We've got long, cold winters. If you're into winter sports, the inland Northwest is the place to be. You've got short, fairly hot summers, and you've got very distinct springs and falls, and that's good for us. Now, here in the coastal area, along the Puget Sound, and along, you know, west of the Cascades, the weather can be strange. This year, for example, summer started very late. June was practically a winter month. It was that cold and chill and gray, and it was that way almost up until the 4th of July. And that's generally when summer begins around here, is 4th of July. Now, for about 2 months here in the Puget area, and I'm speaking to people who, by the way, who hopefully will be considering settling here, for about 2 months in the summer, yeah, it can be hot, it can be muggy, and it can be annoying. It could not, desert-like, burning hot or oven-like hot like it is in, San Antonio, Texas, or not steam bath hot like it is in Charleston, South Carolina, but it's uncomfortably warm. An air conditioner in the Northwest is the ultimate in luxury because you only need it for a couple of months out of the year, and even then, it's only for a few weeks at a time. You never need the type of air conditioning you have in, say, Texas or Southern California or Florida. So it's considered something of a status symbol here. Like right now, I'm sitting here in this closed room, which I have to sit in here so that, people outside gunning their Harleys and everything don't, can't get into my broadcast and so forth. So yeah, it's kind of uncomfortably warm in this room right now. An air conditioner would be nice, but it's not something that I have to have. You kind of need air conditioning in your car because when you leave your car out in the sun here in the Puget Sound area during the summer, yeah, it gets very hot and that's kind of nice to have air conditioning in your car. But in your house, you really don't need it. Like I say, it's considered a luxury. It's a status symbol. And the need for it generally disappears after a few weeks. And then around September, you don't need it anymore. I've had some kind of bad summers here. There was one summer, I think it was 2007, when you might say we never even really had a summer. Of course, that was down on the coast. But I have never known a bad September or October here. When you guys are making your scouting trips, if you're coming to this area or any area west of the Cascades, Portland, Eugene, Centralia, Astoria, wherever, or the Puget Sound area, if you make your scouting trips, I recommend, frankly, that you do it either in September or October, because I have never known a bad September or October here. I will match the color of the fall foliage here in the Puget Sound area against anything I've ever seen in New England or the Appalachian Mountains. It's just that there's less of it. And I think that's enough rambling about the weather. Okay, again, I'm looking over my notes here from previous broadcasts. This is just bits and pieces of things I wanted to talk about, and I can't even remember where most of them came from. Okay, I have something here in my notes that I refer to as the edifice complex, and I wondered what that was for a while, and then I remembered that I'd been meaning to have a little talk with you guys about the whole philosophy or the ins and outs of setting up a headquarters for the Northwest Front here in the Seattle area. Now, some of you may remember from back in the day all those beautiful buildings that our movement used to have. And back in the 1970s, everybody and his kid brother had a building. One thing, real estate was a lot cheaper back in those days than it is now. You didn't have to have a $1 million mortgage just to own a little commercial piece of property. And of course, there were also actually affluent white people in those days who supported us and who would actually do things like back a mortgage for an organization that wanted an open headquarters. But we had new buildings in those days. We had some were in the middle of the cities, like the Arlington Road headquarters, the old Hatemonger Hill headquarters in Arlington, the Rockwell Hall headquarters in Chicago, Cicero, our own HQs down in Raleigh, North Street, Pierce Street, the famous one in El Monte, run by the late Joe Tomasi. And a lot of people to this day will get in touch with me by email saying, "Hey, Harold, I think we may have met, in El Monte in 1972, blah, 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 blah." So these headquarters became sort of social centers and centers of activity for the movement of the time. And they were also sort of like liberated territory. You could actually go to these buildings or these farms like Glenn Miller's place or Robert Miles's farm, or of course the compound at Hayden Lake, and it was like you were stepping onto liberated territory. For a very brief time, you didn't have to look over your shoulder and see who was listening before you said nigger. You could actually have, a picnic and, sit down and have a few drinks or a cup of coffee or something with a fellow white man and have a conversation and not have to worry about getting reported to the politically correct commissars at your work. It was kind of a free speech zone. That was one of the best things about these buildings. Well, they don't exist anymore, and there are some reasons for that. Number one is the fact that basically we don't seem to have anyone coming into the movement anymore who is sufficiently wealthy to afford to maintain a place like this. None of our people seem to own any property anymore. I've noticed that. It's just like the white man as a whole is being slowly stripped of all his wealth that he's accumulated down through the centuries, and so it's very rare actually to run into a movement person who even owns owns their own house anymore, or is even paying a mortgage on their house. Of course, nobody really owns their own home anymore, so long as you have to pay property taxes on it to the government. It's a form of feudalism. In other words, if you don't pay the government tribute for your home, they'll come and take it away. But you get what I'm getting at here. It's just that our people have become so poor that we can't afford to actually own any of our own land anymore. That nowadays is the privilege of rich Jews and corporations. But moving right along, there's also the fact, of course, that people like Morris Dees and his Southern Poverty Law Center and Mark Potok and a few others have discovered the wonders of the malicious and abusive lawsuit. Now, what Morris Dees likes to do is he loves to locate a so-called racist or a racist group with any kind of property at all that he can seize through the abuse of the law. And it could be a house, it could be a private home, it could be an office building, whatever, but he has to have that trophy that he can seize. And what Dees does is he brings these malicious and abusive lawsuits against some racial person for whatever reason, basically to do an end run around the First Amendment. See, the First Amendment says that you're not only supposed to have the right to freedom of speech and freedom of conscience and freedom of thought, but you're also supposed to have these rights free of retaliation. And what Dees does is he uses the civil law or abuses the civil law in order to create a situation of retaliation for the exercise of constitutionally protected rights. Needless to say, since he and his kind own the courts and the judges and make the laws, this fact that what Dees does is totally unconstitutional has been completely ignored, but we won't get into that anyway. So the fact is that Morris Dees has made it virtually impossible for anyone racial to own any property or own their own home, and when they do, they're simply terrified. They're afraid that Dees will bring a lawsuit and seize the property and wave it aloft like a prize or a trophy, and then send out to his mailing list saying, see what I did to the wicked racist, send me millions. See, this is how the Southern Poverty Law Center works. This is how the Southern Poverty Law Center ends up with a $60 million some odd reserve, and that was almost 20 years ago. God knows what it's like now. This is how Dees has made his living for the past 40 years. Basically, he's a shakedown artist. He makes his living off depriving other people of their civil rights through the abuse of the law, and it's just it's a disgusting, wretched situation, and I won't get into it. But anyway, so the fact is that if we do set up a headquarters here in the Northwest Front is going to have to learn to operate below the radar in the sense that we can't own anything that Morris Dees is able to seize or that any federal government agency could seize through some kind of asset forfeiture or anything like that, because that's another thing we've got to worry about. Another reason that we can't really own any property and that the Northwest Front itself can't even really exist is because any assets that we have, be it a bank account, be it an office, be it office furniture or computers or anything like that, if we technically speaking exist and if we own it, then it can be seized through federal asset forfeiture laws if the feds decide that we're violating some kind of hate crime law or whatever. Now, I think a good example of this was what was done to Edgar Steele when he was arrested. The first thing the feds did after they dragged the old man away to his prison cell is that they froze his assets, presumably preparatory to seizure, which is very interesting because it also, of course, has the effect of denying Edgar Steele the right to hire his own lawyer and making sure that he's dependent on a public defender who is being paid by the very system that's trying to put him away. Anyway, I've gotten into all this in the past, but the fact is that in the long run, we are going to have to learn to run a political movement here in the Northwest without any of the usual appurtenances that most political movements have. We are going to have to keep everything to a minimum, and that includes property that might be seized. And this means that we're not going to have too much for a long time in the way of nice compounds of land where we can get together and have picnics and all that sort of stuff. It's unfortunate, but it's necessary. We are going to have to learn as a movement to adapt to the realities of our situation. And one of the realities of our situation is constant persecution from people like Morris Dees and the federal government. And one of the ways that the system persecutes those people who it disapproves of or who try to oppose it is they try to hit their wealth, their assets. So in essence, we are going to have to be very, very careful about owning property, and it might in fact be a good idea for those who want to make up our first 1,000 to kind of, in their own mind, take a vow of poverty or whatever, because frankly, that's probably the way it's going to work out anyway. You're kind of making a virtue out of necessity. And in the second place, one of the ways that the system uses to get at you and to coerce you and to force you into conformity to their will is to use your possessions against you. Now, Americans have been conditioned for many generations to value their possessions above all things, their money, their houses, their cars, etc., etc. And if you own these things, if we as a movement own these things, then they're going to make us vulnerable. They say to the man who has a family has given hostages to fortune. Well, in America, anyone who has material possessions like a house and land and whatnot has also given a hostage to fortune and something that the system can use as a stick to beat him with. And this is actually pretty hopeless, isn't it? I'm just rambling on and on like an idiot here. I don't know how many of you saw a movie called The Departed that came out several years ago. Great gangster flick. I won't ruin the plot for those who haven't seen it, but the Boston PD has a mole inside the Irish mob in Southie, and the Irish mob has a mole inside the Boston PD, and so it turns into a contest as to which mole will out-betray the other. I think Hal Turner would appreciate this one. Anyway, this is the Dropkick Murphys from the soundtrack of The Departed. Yeah, I know this ad-lib stuff is sounding really lame. I'll probably go back to writing a script next week. But for now, let's see. What else can I ramble and rabbit on about? I got an email question here from a new reader named Benson in California. I'm not sure if that's his first or his last name. Anyway, this isn't really a question. It's just one of the usual long moans about how stupid and unable to think white people have become and how it's all really hopeless because white males are such dumbasses, etc., etc., etc. Like I said, this guy's new, and like I've also pointed out before, I'm sure that he believes that these complaints and observations of his are completely new as well, and he's the first one ever to come up with them. He wants to know my thoughts, quote-unquote, on all of this, and normally I'd send him about any one of about 20 canned answers, but since this is my day for maundering into a microphone, why not? Materially, white people are moving forward still at an astonishing rate, and we have been for years. Technologically speaking, I mean, even, you know, 10 years ago, we were back on, what, Windows 98, and now we've got texting and all sorts of stuff and blah, blah, blah. You know, the technological advance of the race is still continuing, but spiritually and politically and socially, we are regressing, and we have been since the close of the 19th century. Even as all this incredible technology around us reaches just wondrous heights that are previously only dreamed of in science fiction, our real level of literacy, intelligence, and concentration and cognitive ability to understand the true nature of events taking place around us has decreased to a level which is, in my opinion, lower than it would have been in, say, the 15th century. Now, we are lesser men not only than our pioneer ancestors, but in many respects, we're lesser men than our far more primitive, remote ancestors in the midst of time. Today, the cognitive understanding of the average white person below 40 years of age regarding the actual facts of geopolitics and the economy and the true nature of the trends and forces at work in society is roughly that of a person of, say, the 11th century, a time before even the chimney had been invented. Now, 1,000 years ago, virtually no one was personally aware of anything that took place outside of an area about 8 or 10 square miles around his village. Now, the perspective of today's white Americans is, in many respects, almost that narrow. A white American today lives in a virtual world of television and the computer screen and various establishment packaged information that appears to be broad and expansive, but which is actually almost totally lacking in truth or value or validity. For 12 years, every day he goes to school, our white boy, and he sits in a classroom with a globe, but a white kid's knowledge of geography is about as accurate as that of a man of 1000 A.D., back in the Clinton years, less than 20% of Americans could find Serbia on a map, even as Bill and Hill murdered Serbian children with napalm. Now, today's white American mind is a mile wide and it's an inch deep, to borrow a phrase. It's true. Joe Sixpack literally has a skull full of mush. Now, in theory, he knows far more than the 11th century peasant who was his 50 times great-grandfather, but when his brain is actually distilled down into hard reality, today's pale face only possesses roughly the same amount of meaningful knowledge as he would have if he'd lived at the beginning of the second millennium instead of the third, and if he'd never ventured more than 10 miles from where he was born. Less, because a modern white man doesn't know how to shoe a horse or plow a furrow or forge iron. All the rest of our so-called knowledge is padding, misconceptions. It's half-truth and silly, useless crap and deliberate lies that are put into our heads by the Jews. Okay, so white people today are lazy, brain-dead morons. It's all been said before and better, I know. Well, rather than beat this to death, we need to begin looking ahead. Now, where's all this heading and how long is it going to last? Now, specifically, how long will these stupid people be able to get by in life now that things are crashing down around them? Now, the average white idiot could get along while we had this artificial Clinton prosperity, and that was back in the 90s, for those of you who don't remember that far. Anyway, it was safe and lethargic, kind of a dot-com world, and made very little demand on people. Basically, that's one of the reasons Clinton got away with a lot of the crap he did, was that while he was president, there were no serious crises, and he pretty much had the whole country on cruise control. Now the environment's changing, and it's going to become necessary for today's pale face to acquire and develop some real survival skills. And a lot of white people aren't going to be able to do that, and they're going to die out like the dodo, at least economically and maybe physically as well. Right now, the white population of America is something like, what, 150 million? And most of them are over 40. The simple fact is that most white Americans simply don't have what it takes to survive in what's coming in the next generation. And I don't mean running around in the woods like Mad Max, you know, playing survivalist or anything like that. I mean, personally, economically, intellectually, you know, maybe physically, you know, medically, who knows? But most white Americans, I don't think, are going to make it. There's going to be a big die-off coming. Nor will white Americans be able to acquire the skills and the character to survive on the spur of the moment when, you know, the time finally gets down to it. Socially, the country and its population, it's going to continue to degenerate into a raceless, sexually perverse, drug-sodden quagmire. It's now pretty obvious that the present political and social social order is incapable of halting or reversing the present flow of third world mud into the United States, even if the Republicans get back in and somehow the political will to do so were found, which isn't going to happen. Now, this is one reason why it's impossible to take back and cleanse the entire United States. The necessary mechanisms of enforcement and repatriation and armed force simply don't exist under liberal democracy. Now, the capitalist economy has become too dependent on cheap third world labor to do all those dirty jobs that American niggers or whites won't do anymore. And we need to grasp that there will never be any truly mass response from the white population to anything that we in the movement do, at least not in the Weimar NSDAP mold that we keep trying to achieve. Now, that was never on the cards. It would never have worked. White people simply don't march in the streets. White people don't act en masse in their own racial interests or indeed in anything other than maybe a football game. White people have been socially engineered and conditioned for the past three generations not to do so. Now, we've been completely isolated and alienated not only from the society in which we live, but from each other. Now, the very concept of ourselves as white people doesn't exist. We consider other races as groups and we consider ourselves to be individuals. It's very difficult to save a people who don't know that they're a people. Now, that's one of the reasons I wrote the Northwest novels, to try and create a sense of a white nation in people. Now, if I can ever get any kind of mass readership for the novels, I honestly think it will work. Okay, I have completely lost track of time. I'm rambling on and on again, and I have no idea how long it's been since the last music break, so here's number three. Now, there's no particular reason for me playing this song, except that I like it. This is the Tannehill Weavers.
And the wild man.
Okay, now I suppose I'll take another crack at the eternal question I get at least 3 or 4 times a week. Can we win, and isn't it really all just hopeless, and why the hell don't I just give up and stop bothering people? Okay, this is my answer number 1341. Now, time and again, I have seen some white man or woman operating with no money out of a garage or a back room have an immense effect on their communities and on the enemy through sheer enthusiasm, courage, dedication, and street smart activism. A good example, for those of you who remember, was a guy named Jim Floyd from Cullman, Alabama. I won't get into a long thing on Jim, but if any of you ever want to know about activism with a capital A, look him up on the internet. That's Jim Floyd. Somehow, we're going to have to attract 1,000 Jim Floyds here to the Northwest and persuade them to place their talents at the disposal of an organized effort to implement the 14 words. And that won't be easy in view of all the horse manure that's going on in everybody's lives right now, but it has to be done. Yes, we can win, but there is only one way. We have to seize state power, and that can only be achieved through revolution. There is neither any need nor any future for a so-called white civil rights organization or any other kosher conservative gibberish like that that politely begs and pleads with a tyrant to be so kind as to cease oppressing us. This kind of activity is pointless. It's an absurd waste of time. It always was, and we just can't be bothering with this crap anymore. Our entire effort must be to prepare for the day when we approach Zog with something in our hands besides our hats. It is not up to the United States of America to give or grant us anything. It is up to us to take back our rights and our freedom if we are man enough to do so, and to die if we're not. Now, if this idea frightens some of you listening to this, go over and whine and complain about it on VNN. That's what VNN is there for. I am going to be very blunt about this. There are times throughout history when corruption and crisis become so acute, when the very fabric of civilization becomes so strained, that mankind must purge the poison from the body politic at any cost. Sometimes there is no other way for this to come about except for the rotten, gangrened limbs to be amputated. Sometimes humanity must literally sweat blood in order to survive. Now, we're headed for such a time, and it's already visible down the road at the end of Obama's tunnel. We have to understand and accept the truth. There is a time of blood, death, and fire on the horizon. And this is not something that we have any choice about. We must understand it, accept it, and prepare for it. Now, we can win this and bring our new nation to birth, but it must all be done right. And it has to be done right from the beginning. I can't overemphasize that we're running out of time, and we can't any longer afford these constant false starts and dead ends and wandering off into the political desert. We did not choose to be born into this time, and indeed many of us, myself included, would have preferred to have been born into some other, but we're here. The crisis is here, and we have a destiny, whether we like it or not. All too many of us have spent the best part of our lives in an attempt to evade that destiny. Now, that's futile at best, and it's wicked at worst. We don't have the right to do that. We have to stop evading and begin the work for which we've been chosen, or our children will curse us in our graves. Well, our time's up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. Now, this is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha and Man, freedom.
Follow in their footsteps of the rising moon.